Welcome to you all to Peninsula Bible Church Cupertino. Great to see so many of you. Lots of faces I don't recognize, so all of you who are visiting us, warm welcome to you. Delighted that you've joined us tonight, and hope that you'll come back Monday and Tuesday as well. Well, it's a great privilege for us to have for these 3 days, to have with us John Stackhouse, who is a professor at Regent College in Vancouver, British Columbia. And he is professor of theology and culture. And there are probably not too many professors of theology and culture. Lots of theology professors, not too many of theology and culture. So he gets to spends his time exploring the interface between Christian faith and the wider world, the wider culture, and teaches about that in various settings. And over the next 3 nights, he's going to address three particular aspects of that interface between Christian faith and wider culture. Tonight is going to address the topic of Christianity and other religions. Tomorrow night, we'll address Christianity and science. And then on Tuesday night, Christianity and sexuality and current sexual standards in the wider world. And these are three topics that arise regularly in conversation with fellow students at school, with work colleagues, with neighbors, with friends who are puzzled by why we believe what we believe as Christians. So tonight, John Stackhouse will talk about other religions. So Jesus, Buddha, Krishna, Lao Tzu, what's the difference and what difference does it make? He's going to talk for a while, and then we'll take a little break to stretch, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers. So if in the course of his presentation you have some question bugging you, keep that in your mind, and you'll get a chance to ask him that later on. So without further ado, let me extend a warm welcome to John Stackhouse. And
well, good evening. Good to see you here. I want to talk to you first about the kind of talk this is so that you'll be able to get me into focus as quickly as possible. This is, as you know, a Christian church, and I'm a Christian professor of Christianity, so that's pretty Christian. Thrice Christian, one might say. And yet the talk tonight is actually not going to be a Christianity-centered talk. I'm not actually going to be a Christian preacher who is going to try to convert you to the Christian faith. Now, that's a really fun thing to do, but I'm not going to try to do that tonight. Instead, the kind of talk this is a talk that comes way before that kind of preaching. And this is more of a kind of lecture, which I hope you understood you were coming to hear, which is why we're not setting it in terms of a worship service. So we're not singing and praying and do those other kinds of things that we would normally do, and we did here this morning and enjoyed that if you were here. But tonight, we've welcomed you to come, whether you are a Christian or not, to think together about a question that everybody thinks about from time to time in our cultures in North America and beyond, namely, what about religious diversity? What about the various claims of world religions? How do we even think about that? And so as a professor of world religions, which I was before I went to Regent College, and now a professor of theology and culture, which really means I get to kind of do whatever I want. That's what theology and culture means. It sounds like something till you think about it, and then theology and X and is really what it is. Tonight I want to give you a sense of how at least I approach this question of competing claims to religious affirmation and adherence around the world and right here in the Bay Area on here on the West Coast. So, you can see I've thrown a bunch of names of leaders up there to stand for this question. Muhammad, Lao Tzu, Krishna, Jesus, Buddha, Kong Tzu, Moses. What's the difference? What difference does it make? Canada is a very small country with a big backyard. So only about 30-some million of us in Canada, and we live on a kind of ribbon of population huddled against the southern border of our country. 90% of Canadians live within 100 miles of the American border. And so there's this little ribbon of a country, and then there's, as I say, this really large backyard. And with only 30-some million Canadians to go around, there aren't that many specialists on any particular subject, and so I get called by the media to help our media, and sometimes your media as well, interpret developments in contemporary religion. And in the first 10 years or so of my return to Canada, because I did my graduate work and my first teaching here in the States, but when I went back to Canada in 1990, I spent the first decade taking calls from press and TV and radio and so on, about 20, 30, 40 interviews a year, actually. And when I talked to journalists, the attitude I would tend to get from them, especially if they worked for mainstream media, was that all religions are good. And that was the sense that they felt they needed to come to me with, even if they privately didn't believe it. But if they were serious journalists, their approach was basically all religions are good. That was before 9/11. And the attitude was sort of everything is beautiful in its own way. Some of you remember that a really awful Ray Stevens song, right, from the 70s? Let me just put that back in your ear again, right? Everything is beautiful, hey, in its own way, yeah. Okay. Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. Yeah. I hear Vegas calling. And it's saying, stay away. After 9/11, though, we didn't reflexively say that. And journalists stopped coming to me that way. It was really interesting. Right after 9/11, suddenly we all wised up to the fact that not all religions are good. Some religions fly planes into buildings. Not all religions, in fact, are good. And so this sense that right-thinking people had in North America, the sense that people who were in the know, people who were cosmopolitan, people who were open-minded, people who were tolerant, who previously had felt that the reflexive position for them should be everything's good in its own way, all religions are good, I don't understand them, some of them seem strange to me, some of them wear funny hats, but I don't really care. They're just different, and that's fine. After 9/11, we had to take a step back from everything is beautiful to say, okay, well, I guess not all the religions are good, so all the good religions are good. Okay. Right. So now, if you're bien pensant, you would think that, yes, all the good religions are good. So how do we think about the differences, even among the so-called good religions? Well, one of the ways to get at this, one of the vivid ways to get at this, is to consider the way some of the religions deal with their religious leaders. And certainly who they revere as a religious leader tells us a lot, of course, about the heart of the religion. So to give this a little bit more graphic and specific shape, we can look at several narratives of what I call the births of the lords. Narratives of Genesis, of course, tell us a lot about a person or a movement. You know, who started it? What kind of person was this? And let me just pick four different ones that illustrate the way leaders come to us in the world religions in very different forms. Perhaps the least known of the four I'll mention is Lao Tzu. Lao Tzu is the pioneer of the philosophical and religious approach known as Taoism. We used to spell it with a T, and now we spell it with a D. It's a little closer to Chinese in the pinyin. So Lao Tzu began, at least, if there really was a Lao Tzu, there's actually a dispute among scholars as to whether there was a Lao Tzu. Otherwise, there's a dispute among scholars as to whether there was really a Homer. But the texts that come from that era, a few centuries before Christ, give us this, to me, quite powerful and attractive philosophy of going with the flow, of understanding the world the way it actually is, and becoming a natural, flowing part of the world, rather than striving against the way the world is, because the world's bigger than you, and the world will crush you if you don't, in fact, figure out the way the world naturally flows. But if you flow with it like water, the softest thing in the world can overcome the hardest thing in the world. And those who stand on tiptoe will wobble. And he who strives can't maintain the pace. But if you emphasize naturalness, if you emphasize the wisdom of seeing the world as it actually is, and follow in the way of the world, the Tao, which is the Chinese word for way, the way of the world, you will have a long, healthy life, which is a great virtue for them. So this is a wisdom tradition. In fact, in Chinese, Taoism has two different suffixes. One of them indicates a philosophical stream, and the other indicates a very different form of Taoism, which is much more closely tied to Chinese folk religion and magic and so on, and it's got a different suffix. Taoism, in this earlier sense that I'm describing it then, this more primitive or basic sense of a philosophy, suggests then wisdom. This is the way of the world. You see, there's no God or gods. There's nothing supernatural about it. It's just taking the world as it is, getting it into focus, and living appropriately. And when Lord Laozi was born, he was born a very wise man. And as a way of indicating his preternatural wisdom later in life, the Chinese story has him being born already old. In fact, he was born 60 years old. And here's a lovely picture of him, which is not quite big enough for you to see. But baby Laozi is actually bearded, standing up in his bath. He was actually born 60 years old with a long white beard, already bald. And then as an act of filial piety, which of course is important in China, he fell to the floor and cried like a baby and expected his mom to pick him up. And then once that was done with, he stood up and began to teach. So this charming narrative is trying to get across the point. I don't think any Taoists take this as literal truth, but the point is to illustrate the great wisdom of their great sage. If we spin the globe a little bit to India, we come across Gautama Siddhartha. And Gautama Siddhartha was, of course, the one that we all get to know as the Buddha. When he was born, his birth was prophesied, and there's lots of different Buddhist narratives, so I'm picking and choosing among those narratives to give you, I think, a kind of where the Venn diagrams overlap. It was prophesied that he would come. His mother knew that something wonderful was happening in her womb, and she was a princess or queen, actually, herself. And when he was born supernaturally. Mom just leaned against a plum tree, and out he came from her side, which is the most miraculous part of this, pain-free. And when he was born, flowers fell from heaven, and various supernatural beings rejoiced, and he stepped on lotuses as a sign of his heavenly origin and his great wisdom. And he had the several dozen marks of specialness on his body. If you notice the statues of Buddha that you've seen, he has very long earlobes, so elongated earlobes, golden skin, webbed fingers and toes, and a variety of other marks to show that this is no ordinary baby. And the sage, who was consulted by his father, the king, said, yes, he will become either a great monarch or a great spiritual leader. And here's a lovely picture of the birth of Buddha. See, mom's just, you know, leaning ever so lightly against the tree, and out comes her lovely glowing baby. Off he goes. Now, of course, dad didn't want the kid to become a holy man, right? Dad's a king. He wants his kid to go in the family business, become a king. And off begins the distinctive career as the Buddha, as he is protected from the world and anything that would distress him, because in India, that's usually the way religious thoughts are triggered, by looking at a difficult world and how to deal with that, how to understand that. But he eventually takes a famous chariot ride, in fact, and sees the four great sights of a poor man and a sick man and a dead man and a holy man, and decides that he needs to get out in the big world and understand the way it is, takes up Hindu asceticism for a while. That doesn't work for him. Sits under the Bodhi tree, eats just enough to keep himself going, and achieves enlightenment. And sees the way the world actually is. And then from there begins his distinctive teaching career, helping other people see the world as it actually is. And enlightenment is Bodhi, of course, in Sanskrit, and he becomes the Buddha, the one who sees things the way they are because he has been enlightened. The light's gone on for him. He sees the way reality really is. So this birth narrative clues us in to the fact that this is going to be a great man who's going to change the world, and he's going to see things the way the rest of us don't, and he can lead us in a path that we otherwise wouldn't be able to follow. Now, the Hindu tradition is, as I suggested this morning, extremely variegated, but one of the most popular strands in Indian religion is the way of devotion to a particular god, Bhakti Marga. And Bhakti, that is devotion to a particular god rather than philosophy or just doing your duty, is the way most Hindus historically and today practice their faith, trusting in a god or a god to help us do what we cannot do for ourselves, to bring us along a path of salvation eventually. And Krishna is one of the most revered, arguably the most revered of Hindu gods, and is himself a kind of apparition or appearance, an avatar of the great god Vishnu. And when Vishnu, who periodically comes back to earth to help human beings remember what they forgot that he told them the last time, Vishnu comes back this time in the form of this beautiful baby boy. Now, to Western eyes, this kid's in big trouble because he's cyanotic. You medical people know that generally we don't like blue babies. That's a problem for us. We want them to be pink. But here, his blue skin is perfectly healthy. In fact, it shows his heavenly origins. Yeah, he is from the sky, and so he is blue like the sky. And he grows up in a village. Actually, there was a demon that was threatening to kill him at birth, and so there was a swap. And he ended up in disguise growing up in the village of Vrindavan, and grew up as a cute little boy who'd run around mischievously stealing sweets and butter. And then when he became a teenager, looking a little more like this guy, he played a wonderful magic flute and would go out among the cowherds, the women that would go out to look after the cows while the husbands were away. And he would play his flute for them, and he would dance with them, and then he multiplied himself and made love to them all at the same time. This is one of the stories that I guess they teach in Hindu Sunday school, and they may well get more attendance than we do. That's some pretty exciting stuff. Now this story, which obviously has multiple meanings, is meant to convey the great love of God for everyone, and that God can be everyone's lover. God can, in fact, be with us all, and God is a God of warmth and kindness and love. And he starts off as this wonderful, isn't that cute? I mean, he's so cute, right? This angelic little heavenly baby. If we go to a fourth Lord, we come to the Christian Lord, Jesus. And you can see that Jesus doesn't have the same taste in clothes. In fact, he doesn't have really particularly impressive taste at all. It seems to be more like peasant garb, which in fact he was. And he was born in even worse surroundings. I mean, he's just literally wrapped in a kind of blanket. This is an actual photograph of Jesus. If you're going to come out on a Sunday night, you might as well get everything you paid for, right? Which was nothing. Yeah. So this is a rendition of the baby Jesus wrapped in swaddling clothes, just wrapped in cloth, and then lying in a manger, in a feeding trough. And even though the Christian Bible says that this one who is born is in fact God made human, and there are angels that testify to his divinity, so there's supernatural elements in the story, the main thrust of the story is just how very human this kid is. He doesn't have blue skin. He doesn't have long earlobes. He doesn't have golden skin. He doesn't have webbed fingers or toes. He's really an unremarkable baby. And when the angels appear to human beings to tell them to celebrate the birth of Jesus, and again, the very earthiness of this birth is that the only people they seem to be able to find are shepherds, which are the lowest of the low. And, I mean, the shepherds are a bad bunch, right? These are the guys that can do nothing else except sit up all night watching sheep. And how hard a job can that be? We're going to hire you to watch paint dry, okay? We hire these guys to be shepherds outside these little towns, and they would often pilfer stuff while people were sleeping to increase their diet in some way. So these ragamuffin types are the ones that the angels appear to, and this will be the sign unto you. And everybody who's seen the Charlie Brown special knows this will be the sign unto you, this baby, you'll be able to find the baby you're looking for, because as you go through the dark streets of Bethlehem, you'll be looking for the baby that is incandescently lighting up the night. That's how you'll know. Jesus is the world's largest nightlight, and he'll just be glowing away in the manger with all his heavenliness. But that's not what, in fact, the angels say, even though that's the way our Christmas cards depict Jesus. Like, this will be a sign unto you. Look for the glowing kid, you know. Instead, the sign is almost the opposite. This will be a sign unto you. Look for a baby wrapped in swaddling clothes. Big deal. Every baby is wrapped up to keep them warm and keep their limbs from flailing. Lying in a manger, that's what's unusual about this kid, is that he doesn't even have a crib. It's his abject poverty. He's not even in a proper bed for a baby. And this is to signal right away that Yahweh, the great God of the Jews, has decided to come right down among us to the lowest of the low, that there is no human being that is too low for Jesus to connect with. That he's not coming down to the princely level, he's not coming down to the level of the sage, he's coming down to the desperately poor peasant class. So everybody, in a sense, will be able to connect with this incarnation of God. That's at least what the Christian emphasis, it seems to me, in the symbolism of the birth of Jesus. So just picking four birth narratives, we see that these four narratives show us four quite different takes on how to conduct our lives, on how to be religious. Now, of course, religious leaders seem to us to be similar. They say overlapping things. They talk about wisdom in some similar ways. They talk about ethics in some similar ways. I'd like to say thank God they do, because that way we can actually connect with each other across religious lines and form neighborhoods and partnerships and countries like yours and mine. The leaders clearly are similar, but they're also importantly different. If we think of Buddha, Gongzi, whom we know as Confucius, and Laozi, these are great sages. These are wise men, philosophers, we might say, who tell us the way things actually are. I'm going to pause just for a minute. Those of you who are standing at the back, there's not many of you, there are actually seats in the very front row, and if you want to come up around the sides, we'll all not notice you while you come up and sit here if you want to, because I'm not that interesting, so at least you should be comfortable while you stand. So you're welcome to come forward if you'd like to. And if you want to, if you've got the empty seats and squeeze in a little bit, that'll help. There's just a few folks who need to. So Buddha, Gongzi, Laozi are sages. If we look at, look at that wonderful community spirit there. So come on forward if you want to have a seat. Don't make these people move in vain. We all hate that. Great. Okay, thank you. If we pick a couple of other famous leaders, Moses from the Jews and Muhammad from the Muslims, these are prophets and what I might call loosely politicians. These are people who not only bring prophetic words of God, but also are the political leaders of their tribes who actually lead their people physically and politically on journeys of, in the case of Muhammad, of conquest. Moses' lieutenant Joshua does the conquering in their story. And then if we come to Krishna, we have what I call an avatar who brings us revelation of God, shows us what God is like, and instructs us about God's word from a Hindu point of view. And then the Christians understand Jesus to be an incarnation, a becoming flesh, which reveals God and instructs us, but also does what none of the others do, which is to save the world. In some way, Jesus does for the world what the world can't do for itself. So if you get even to World Religions 101, which is where we're approaching tonight, you see that these leaders are quite different from each other. They're similar in some ways to some of the others. They're not utterly different from each other, but they're pretty different in these different categories. They exercise different roles, and their teachings are importantly different as to their particular religions. So I want to initially suggest that we can't presume what in some of us we really like to presume, but I don't think the evidence is there to presume that all roads lead to the same mountaintop. Now, I was told in one of my first World Religions classes as a student that they did. Or at least that's what all enlightened people understood, is that all roads lead to the same mountaintop. But it's not obvious to me, as I look at some of those roads, that they even want to go to the same place. I mean, none of the world religions actually claim that. There are certain minority traditions in Hinduism, in Christianity, in Judaism, Islam, and a couple of others, minority traditions that suggest that all roads lead to the same mountaintop, particularly the mystical traditions in each of those faiths. But the religion, the world religions themselves generally don't claim that they are all actually more or less the same. In fact, they claim something quite different, that we're right. That's what they claim. And the other competing faiths are not as right as we are, at least. I think we also can't presume that niceness or goodness or even love is enough. Now, it might be, but I don't think we can presume that. You hear what I'm arguing right now? It may be that all roads lead to the same mountaintop, but I don't think we can presume that, given how very different the religions are. Secondly, the world religions themselves don't seem to say that being nice or being even morally good or even being loving is enough. I mean, none of them boil their own religious ethics down to even something as high as love. They all seem to add other things. You have to believe other things. You have to practice other things. You have to feel other things than those. Even though in contemporary North American culture, there's a lot of people who would prefer to think that that's all the religions are really saying. All you need, after all, is love. Now, I can't remember which famous religious leader said that, but but at one point he was more popular than Jesus Christ, as I think he said in a perhaps a loose news conference. I don't think we can even presume that just any sort of spirituality will do. Now, I don't know quite what it's like down here in the Bay Area, but up in Vancouver, this is a very popular belief that I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. I'm not some crass materialist. I'm not some money-grubbing, shiny tower inhabitant. I have a spiritual side too, which I define any way I want. And pretty much any sort of spirituality will do, because spirituality is just good. Well, again, I don't see any of the world religions at least claiming that. They seem to think that only certain kinds of spirituality are good, and many of them, if not all of them, claim that certain kinds of spirituality are actually bad, that there's actually a dark side to the spiritual realm, and that people can have bad spirits. People can even have trade with bad spirits. So I don't know that we can easily presume that any sort of spirituality will do either. So if we consider the religions as at least apparently pretty different, I don't mean now by different mutually exclusive. As I've suggested, there are overlapping teachings, overlapping practices, overlapping roles of the leaders. So I don't think we have to presume that they're all utterly different from each other. Clearly they're not. I mean, Judaism believes in one God, and so do Christians, so do Muslims, and so do certain forms of devotional Hinduism. So they're not utterly different from each other, but they are, it sounds to me, like they're importantly different from each other. So how would we decide among them? Let's talk about difference, let's talk about similarity, and then let's talk about truth. Advocates of particular religions tend to make the similar kind of claim for their guy, whether it's Muslims on behalf of Muhammad, or whether it's Buddhists on behalf of Buddha, or it's devotees of Krishna on behalf of him, or Jesus people, and so on. Advocates tend to say, there is no one exactly like our guy. He's really special. He's not like the others. There's no one exactly like him. And that's true. It's also not interesting. Because, in fact, no one's exactly like you either. And I don't care. I mean, you're wonderful people, and each of you is a wonderful snowflake, unique in its own way, but, you know, really, I don't care, right? I mean, you're mostly a faceless mass of an audience tonight to me. I don't know. I mean, if I were a loving, warm-hearted person, I would care about each one of you in turn, but I'm pretty shallow, so I don't care that much. But of course everyone's unique. Of course Muhammad's unique. Of course Moses is unique, and Jesus is unique, and Krishna's unique, and you're unique, and I'm unique. You know, we're all unique. Hooray, you know? And I'm reminded of that classic line from The Incredibles, right? If everybody's special, then I guess no one is. Wisdom, once again, from Pixar. Notice the reference to the town I'm in right now. Isn't it? See how cleverly I managed to work in a little Cupertino thing there? Yeah, years of experience. Okay. What matters is not uniqueness, and what matters is not similarity either. It doesn't matter if the religious leaders are unique, and it doesn't matter if they're similar, because they could all be uniquely wrong, or they could all be similarly wrong. What matters is what the religions themselves say matters, namely what's true. That's what matters. So to get excited about a religion because it's so different from the others is really not a rational thing to do, because it could just be wacky, right? I mean, the Branch Davidians were pretty different from other religions too, but I'm not hurrying down to revive the cult in Waco, nor should you be. The idea that the religion is different from the others doesn't matter. Uniqueness doesn't matter. What matters is what the religions themselves say matters, namely what's true. You see, religions can be understood as solutions to problems. There's lots of ways of understanding religions, but one of the key ways that we use in the academy is to understand religions as problem-solution complexes. Religions, no matter what the religion is, and it could be a proper noun religion like the ones we're talking about tonight, Shintoism, Buddhism, Sikhism, Taoism, and so on, or it could be lowercase religions like secular humanism or certain forms of Marxism and so on, or it could just be your own personal spirituality. Whatever it is that you use to construct your life, whatever you wrap your life around, that functionally is your religion, right? It might be, as I say, a proper noun religion like Christianity. It might be devotion to the Stanford Cardinal, and you run your life around, you know, their particular athletic schedule. You might be a fanatic of a particular rock band, whatever it might be. But proper noun religions and the more informal kinds as well are all trying to give us a map of reality. This is the way the world is. This is what really matters in the world. And here's how we negotiate this territory best. That's what religions are for. So they answer questions like these. What's the highest good that we can realistically hope for? Now notice, not what's the highest good I can imagine. I mean, I can imagine an endless day on the beach, but if that's not available to me, then the religion will say, well, sorry, but there is no endless day at the beach. Instead, there's this, whatever that might be. So what's the actual highest good, the summum bonum that we can hope for in the cosmos? What's the problem? Most of us don't think we're actually living that life right now, and the religions agree. The world religions generally say, most human beings are not currently enjoying that highest good. So what's the problem that keeps us from that? Thirdly, what's the proposed solution to that problem? And each of the world's religions give us a particular solution to that problem. And all in all, if we tie these together, the overall explanation is what's real, what's actually the case. Each of the world's religions give us a map of reality. This is the way the world actually is. So whatever you happen to think, whatever your fantasies are, whatever your hopes and dreams, this, I'm telling you, is the way the world is. This is the highest good we can hope for. This is what keeps us from enjoying that. Here's how to get there. And our religion will help you get to that highest good, okay? So whatever religion you're studying, you can get to the heart of that religion by answering these questions. If you can answer those questions well, you've understood the basic dynamic of whatever religion you're investigating. Let me give you two illustrative examples then. I'm going to take two world religions and give you a sense of how they respond to these and how very different they are from each other. And let's pick two big ones. Let's pick Buddhism and Christianity. Let's talk then first about Buddhism. Now, those of you who know Buddhism well will know that the Buddhist tradition actually is divided into two major divisions, the Theravada and the Mahayana. And that even within that, there is the Vajrayana tradition out of Tibet, and there's multiple schools and multiple national versions of things. Chan Buddhism in China is very similar to, but not quite the same as Zen Buddhism in Japan and so on. So to simplify things for the sake of tonight's presentation, I'm going to speak about the early tradition, the tradition of the elders, the Theravadan tradition. recognizing that in fact most Buddhists in the world have opted for the Mahayana tradition, which I see as a kinder, gentler version of Theravada. But Theravada is the original layer of the tradition of the elders. In this view, the highest good is nirvana. Now, here on the West Coast of the United States, this term has been somewhat confused by a particular, not particularly lamented, rock band up toward my neck of the woods in Seattle. But nirvana, whether it's understood in that sense or in the Flower Children understanding of nirvana as bliss, right? In the Flower Children, which is a little closer to home here, nirvana was groovy, baby. Right? It was what you, if you had particularly good product, nirvana could get you there. Some of you are nodding, and in fact, you shouldn't be, because the DEA is everywhere, and so I wouldn't go, you know, yeah, too quickly. It's statute of limitations on a few of those things. Anyway, the highest good in the Theravada tradition is not happiness, it's not bliss. In fact, it's quite a bit more reduced than that. I'm going to cycle back to this because these are all connected. The problem in the world is suffering. And as the Buddha, on his little carriage rides, saw the poor man and the sick man and the dead man, and his honest to a fault driver says, "This, my prince, will happen to you too," the Buddha realized that no matter how much wealth you could have, and he had a lot, he was a prince, no matter how much health you could enjoy, no matter how long a life you had, eventually you would lose it. Old age, if nothing else, would rob you of it, and death would finally take everything away. And his abiding sense of enlightenment was that really the main problem in the world is that we have desire, we cling to things. We want what we don't have, and we worry about losing what we do have. And so we have the misery of not getting everything we want. And who has everything they want, right? I mean, part of what's making me unhappy these days is that I have noticed that Bombardier and Gulfstream have brought out jets newer than mine. I jest. I'm a theologian. There are no theological jets, right? Right? There's always something new. There's always something better. There's always something. And so I want what I don't have, and then I worry at the same time about keeping what I do have against thieves, against a bad market, against repairs coming up. And so this negative, this pain of unsatisfied desire and this pain and worry of anxiety in the Buddha's view outweighs all the happiness you can have in your life. It eventually eats away at your joy. And so the problem of suffering arising from desire needs to be solved, but the highest good we can hope for is not a Hindu idea, which he originally had, of going to a heaven. In the standard dharma karma cycle in Hinduism, if you do your dharma, you do your religious duty, you're reincarnated, and then eventually your good karma piles up so much that you get to go to heaven. And that is a day at the beach. It is really terrific, and there's various stories and pictures of how fun these heavens really are, but they're like any other vacation. Eventually your money runs out. Your good karma is used up, and then you have to descend again into the endless cycle of reincarnation. Now, the Buddha actually came to see that there was no such thing as these heavens, that in fact we just get cycled through earthly lives, and we keep having sadness and grief and disappointment, suffering because of this perpetual problem of clinging to what we don't have and clinging to what we do have. And so the key to enjoying the best existence possible is to not cling, is to not hold on, is to detach. And if you don't care, you can't hurt. And so nirvana is not bliss. Nirvana, in this early teaching of Buddhism, is the state of the candle flame when the candle's blown out. Instead of burning with desire that can't ever be fully satisfied, you just stop burning. You stop consuming yourself with suffering and frustration, and you enjoy the peace of the extinguished candle flame. That's actually the vision of nirvana in early Buddhism. Now, you might say, this sounds pretty grim, but some of you have perhaps seen, you know, the closest example I can think of is love affairs that we have, when, especially if you've had one or two or three in a row that have all ended badly, and what do you say? I'll never fall in love again, right? Because the pain I feel from having my heart broken outweighs all the fun I had while my heart wasn't broken, so that's it. It's better not to love. Well, that's what Buddha, in a sense, is saying, but on a general scale. And so the solution offered is the example of the Buddha himself, the teaching of the community, the Dharma, and the community itself, the Sangha, so that you get an example to follow, teaching to instruct you, and a community to join to help you learn the disciplines such that you too can come to see the world as it is, you can enjoy enlightenment eventually, and you will be then able to be spiritually free of desire and leave this world and leave everything for this state of peace, understood as not suffering. Right? So that's one way of seeing the cosmos. The Christian view is not like that. Like, it's really not like that. It's not necessarily better or worse. It's not necessarily truer or falser. In this particular conversation, I'm not taking sides. I've already let you know what side I'm on. But for the sake of our conversation, let me try to be as objective as I can be. The Christian view is quite different. The highest good for Christians is this Hebrew word, shalom, rather than the Sanskrit word nirvana. Shalom is translated in the Bible as the word peace. But it's much fuller, it's a much richer word than the word peace. In the Christian view, the highest good we can hope for is this concept of shalom, which, as I say, is translated in the Bible as the word peace. But in English, peace can be a pretty weak word. It can be a pretty negative word. My wife and I are the parents of three sons, and sometimes all I want at home is a little shalom and quiet. Right? And all I mean by that is shut up, you know, like just stop making so much noise. That's all I want, a little peace and quiet. So that's not what the Bible means by peace. What the Bible means by peace when it talks about shalom is something more like flourishing. This is a wonderful idea. It's one of my favorite words, actually, shalom. And the biblical view of the highest good is every individual element in God's world. Human beings, yes, but also animals and trees and other kinds of physical structures. Every individual element is what it ought to be. Everything is functioning optimally, we might say. So everyone is fully themselves, the best version of themselves, and everything is like that. But also, every relationship among the individuals is working the way it's supposed to. Everybody relates to everybody else in a healthy and flourishing way. And then every group functions the way it's supposed to. Every business functions the way it's supposed to. Every school functions the way it's supposed to. Every church functions the way it's supposed to. Every government functions the way it's supposed to. I mean, this is almost, you know, delirious. Right? my head's exploding, you know. So fantastic. And then every group relates to all the constituent individuals the way it's supposed to. Every government treats every citizen the way it's supposed to. And every school treats every student the way it's supposed to. And every business treats every customer the way it's supposed to. And then all these groups interact with each other the way they're supposed to. So government and finance and labor and the educational systems and the health systems, they all interact with each other properly. And all of these then interact with the physical world and the rest of our natural neighbors, the rest of creation, in a healthy and symbiotic way. And all of that relates properly to God. It's this literal global view of flourishing. Now that's what the Hebrew and the Christian Bible gives us as the view of what God wants. God loves the world. He doesn't just mean the human population. He loves the world. And the whole world is what God has in mind to refurbish and renew and have properly functioning. So the highest good that humans are to look forward to is this idea of a renewed earth where we are renewed such that we can function properly and optimally with each other. This, by the way, is very different from the typical Christian heresy that we're all going to heaven. Now, you may have thought that you were going to heaven, and I'm here to tell you you're not. And you think, well, I was really glad I came to church to hear that. That's actually what my mom's been saying for quite a while, but she's not going there either, right? So what I'm saying is we're not going up to heaven. The idea of dying and having your disembodied soul migrate to some spiritual place is a Greek idea, it's an Indian idea, but it's not a Christian idea. We're not. This is the vision that we have been traded for a long time in Christian circles. And some of it comes from the Middle Ages. Some of it comes from Far Side cartoons. You get your theology where you can. I'll get it from where I can. But we have this idea that the highest good we can imagine is something like this. I die as a Christian, good church goer, did everything I'm supposed to do. I die, and I meet St. Peter at the pearly gates, and I'm given this white, shapeless robe to wear, and I'm issued a harp, and I'm told to go over to cloud 227B, and I sit on my stand, maybe on my cloud, and I start playing harp. And other people are around me on their clouds playing harp back at me. So we just play harp at each other, like forever. I don't like harp music that much. But the worst thing about this is that I can't die. And for that, you want me to give up adultery? I don't think so. No, she's worth more than that. You want me to give up greed and lust and all those other deadly sins? Baby, I'm there. Because that sounds like hell to me. The world's longest boring church service. No, that's not what Christians are saying, or at least that's not what we should be saying. At the end of the Bible, check the last two chapters of the Bible. You'll see that when Jesus returns, the heavenly city comes down from heaven to earth. The vector's wrong. We're not going up. We might go up to greet Jesus in the air. 1 Thessalonians says we're going to meet him in the air. But it's like we're hurrying out to the city limits to welcome him as he comes in. But we go up to meet him in the air, but we're all coming back down again. Because the New Jerusalem is a city on a new planet. That's what we're looking forward to. We're not going up to heaven, we're going forward to a new era of human and global flourishing. That's the Christian view. So what keeps us from that? What's the problem? In the Christian view, the problem here is sin. And sin is a kind of total systemic malfunction. Christian understanding of sin is a kind of derangement of human beings. It has actual physical consequences, but the main consequences are mental, psychological, spiritual. In the kind of ego center that each of us have, we tend to see the world askew, and we tend to understand the world in a way that's off-center, and our appetites and desires don't actually line up with the way things actually are, and so our self-interest grows grossly out of proportion, and it's misdirected. I mean, self-interest is a perfectly appropriate thing to have. I mean, of course you're supposed to look out for your best interest. That's what the appeal of the Christian gospel is here's where your self-interest lies. You just think it lies somewhere else. There's a way that seems right to you, but that's the way of death. This is the way that you should go. So self-interest is what all organisms have, and Christians shouldn't be against that. By the way, I'm sorry, some Christians are. They think that the ideal for Christian life is agape. It's a kind of selfless love where I don't care at all about myself. I just care all about you, which you might know is psychologically impossible. So happily, you don't have to do that because you can't do that. I mean, I don't have to love my kids like that. In fact, I should love my kids like a parent should, where I love them in a circle of love. When I love my kids and they flourish, I feel good about that. And you might say, well, that's pretty selfish of you, but you don't understand. Like I do give up things for them, my own pleasures, my own money. lots of my own money. But when they flourish, because I love them, I flourish too. And that's what it means to be in a symbiotic relationship of love. That's what we should be doing. So the problem of sin is that it breaks everything that's supposed to be whole. It breaks relationships. It breaks my own attitudes. It, as I call it, it's kind of a total systemic malfunction. Now, don't get me wrong. It doesn't mean that the whole system comes crashing to a halt. Clearly, that's not true. People clearly love other people. People conduct business fairly and profitably. People educate each other. They care for each other medically. I mean, lots of the system still works. I'm just saying there's a kind of malfunction that's through the whole system so that it keeps breaking down in all sorts of ways. Massive ways like genocide, all the way down to serious ways like people not being able to decide how much money the Bay Bridge is going to cost and who should pay for it and all those sorts of things, to even minor things like the fact that the speaker tonight is just not that interesting, right? There's all sorts of problems in the system, from relatively trivial to relatively important. And this kind of brokenness is interrupting shalom. Now, the solution to this from the Christian point of view is simple. Everybody should just try harder. You should try harder. You're not trying hard enough, and neither are you, nor are you. And if you just had faith, which is another way of trying hard, so I just believe, and I only believe at sort of 7 units, but if I could just believe 9 units of faith, I'm at about 8 now. Yes, 9, you know? I mean, I don't even know what that means. Have more faith. Okay, well, I'll just go to the, you know, just input faith, and it's like a video game. I'm boosted up to 9, you know, in faith. I don't know what that means. If we just had more faith and we just tried harder, but we've been trying harder for quite a while and our record is mixed, right? So trying harder to be nice, trying harder to be moral has had what we call a mixed record. We're not entirely successful about that. In fact, Christianity is one of the religions of the world that says you can't do it by trying harder. You cannot do it by dint of either mystical discipline or by moral discipline. You're not going to do it that way. Those are important, to have spiritual discipline and a moral discipline, but you are going to need a savior. You're going to need more energy in the system than the system currently has. God is going to have to inject energy into the system. You can't jump high enough on your own. You cannot heal from that disease on your own. You cannot solve your mental illness on your own. Individually or corporately, God is going to have to intervene in order to give you what you do not have. Doesn't mean that you're completely passive. Doesn't mean that there's nothing for you to do. It does mean, however, that we need a savior. We need someone to both take away the consequences of our sin and to rehabilitate us into our full maturity, right? Because there's two things here. We want to get away from the constant problem of our sin and the consequences of our sin, but we also, even if that was taken care of, even if everybody enjoyed universal forgiveness right here, right now, from our past, it would be how long till we sin again, right? How many seconds till we sin again? So we can't just have forgiveness. We need to grow up. We need to become what we can be. We need to be shalomful, so to speak. And so we need a lot of energy in the system, actually. We need to have our sins forgiven, and we need to be made right. This is what the Christian answer is. And you can see that this is a very different picture of the world, of what's wrong with the world, what we can hope for, and how we get there. Now, how would you choose? How would you even begin to think about choosing between Buddhism and Christianity? And then factor in all the other religions, great and small. How would a sensible person even begin to know and decide about these things? You're going to be so disappointed by this answer. It's pretty thrillingly set up, wasn't it? Well, same way we decide about anything else. There's the answer. In other words, not magic and not the product I'm selling at the back. Wouldn't it be great if I had one? But no, not a new app for your phone. The same way we decide about anything else, like this. What corresponds to our knowledge? And what coheres with our knowledge? We all think we know certain things about the world, right? We've all lived a certain number of years. We've lived in various places. We've had different kinds of jobs and family experiences and romances and disappointments and successes and failures. We've got this certain store of experience and knowledge, and we know that not all of it's completely right, and we know that we've got misunderstanding, but that's what we got. Each of us has got what we got. And so as we look at Buddhism, we look at Christianity, we look at whatever the options are that are most appealing to us, because again, you can't look at them all. I mean, who has time for that, right? Do you really want to try to investigate all the world's religions seriatim? Like, oh, I think that's what I should do. I think I should canvass all the world's religions. I think I'll get a PhD in each one. And then, when I'm 200 years old, I will convert to each one after one after the other, so I'll know what it's like from the inside. And then I'll deconvert, and then I'll reflect on that. Now that I'm 400 years old, you see, it can't be done. So so instead, all we can do is what we can do, which is to look at the options that currently make the most sense to us and figure, now, these are the claims. What corresponds to what I think the world is like? What coheres with the things I think I already know are true? And then, since religion is supposed to help me actually negotiate the world, what helps me live as I ought to live? Like, what else can you do? You can only try to make sense of things as best you can. But what I mean by making sense of them is to remember that religions are about everything, and so everything pertains. So if you're weighing up Buddhism and Christianity, say, think about how well does Buddhism explain not just certain feelings that you have, how well does it explain science? How compatible is it with contemporary science? How compatible is it with art and with your intuitions about the aesthetic? How well does Buddhism help you discipline your children in a way that you think makes most sense? How well does Buddhism help you decide which car to buy or whether you should buy a car or not? Does Buddhism or Christianity help you better in terms of thinking of civic life, who you should vote for, whether the party system of democracy is really the right way, and if it is, which party you should belong to? Religions are meant to help us organize the very center of our lives so that everything else falls into place. So we can test religions on literally anything and everything. Do they really, in fact, help me make more sense of life than the other options I'm considering? See, the religions don't agree. And it seems to me impossible to imagine that they can all be equally right. I mean, maybe they are, but I can't imagine how the various claims of all the world's religions can possibly be equally right. Now, please hear me on this. I don't mean to say that only one religion is right and all the others are totally wrong, because that can't be true either, because there's so many overlaps of teaching and so on. What I'm saying is I don't think you can say the opposite, that they're all equally right, because I don't know what that would mean to say that there is no God, and there is one God, and there is two gods, and there is three gods, and there's 9 million gods, and they're personal, except they're not personal. Like, I don't know how you would possibly construct a kind of amalgam of all the world's religious teachings. They can't all be equally right. And these are the most important issues in the world. So in conclusion, I simply suggest that we consider these options the way we consider any serious decision, with the seriousness it deserves, to investigate them, to really get to know what we need to know in order to weigh them up according to the way we have to weigh up anything else in life, which is what makes the most sense to us, what is going to help us make the most sense of our lives. And I encourage you to consider them as if your life depended on it. Because one of the things I find on the West Coast is that a lot of people give less thought to opting for a religion than they do for buying a refrigerator. They'll actually do a little work on Consumer Reports about a fridge. But when it comes to religion, well, you know, I just feel that this is right. You know, and my car apparently has a problem with the front right wheel, and I just feel that that's the way I should repair it. And I have a burning pain in my lower right quadrant, and this is what I feel I should do to treat that myself. And I think, really? You don't really want to think about this a bit and get some information and maybe decide where you're going to be spending the rest of whatever? So I encourage you to think about that the way you could. I'm going to invite our friend to come on up and lead us in a break. But while you're thinking about what you need to think about for the question and answer time, this is the textbook that I have been using for 20-some years. It's just recently become criminally expensive. It's gone the way of all textbook flesh. You know, those of you in engineering and in science and in medicine, you've been paying way too much for textbooks for a long time. Well, now the humanities are catching up. This book apparently is now $130. Yes. I'm glad to hear it's expensive for you, too, because that seems like it's probably a little, it's not much less. But the happy thing is it's gone through multiple editions. They're available used all over the place. And guess what? The world religions haven't changed that much in 10 years. So buy used. And then if you don't get a chance to talk to me tonight and you'd like to follow up with me, there's my email address. But Bernard, why don't you come on up and tell us what we're going to do next.
Okay, we've got about 20 minutes for Q&A. Seek to end at 8:30. So if you'd like to ask John a question, we've got a couple of roving mics, so I'll have one, and Ryan back there has one. So put up your hand, and we'll come find you, pass you the mic. And speak clearly, and hold the mic close to your mouth. So, who has questions?
Well, it seems that there aren't any. Well, good night, thanks.
Matthew?
Yeah.
Boss?
No. No. Maybe one or two.
So I heard you mention that actually most people today, most Buddhists today, have slightly different beliefs. Is it possible to give a short explanation as to what exactly the difference is?
Yeah. The greater vehicle of Mahayana, which includes, is greater in a number of ways, including more people follow it, is the instinct among Buddhists that the way of the elders, the Theravada, is too difficult. And it is very difficult. Only monks are able to actually achieve nirvana that way. And so the instinct in Mahayana, which is by far more popular in China, Japan, and in parts of Southeast Asia, although other parts of Southeast Asia are Theravada, the sense is that there is more to be hoped for and more help available, if I can put it that way. Nirvana is understood as blissful, as happy, rather than a kind of zero. And we can get to that happy state with the help of a variety of Buddhas and other spiritual adepts known as bodhisattvas who have, out of compassion, decided to hang around, so to speak, in this cosmos rather than going into nirvana themselves, and be available to us if we pray to them and ask for their help, because pray just means asking for help. And that's why in many of the temples in Vancouver, for instance, most of them are Mahayana, and you'll see these various Buddhas and Bodhisattvas represented symbolically. Many of the temples you visited other places in the world will be Mahayana. And you come in and light your incense sticks and ask for help from the particular Buddhas or Bodhisattvas with whatever it is you happen to need. And in that sense, that form of religion obviously connects with forms of devotional Hinduism, forms of devotional Christianity towards saints, and so on, where there's a sense in which there are helpers up there who can help me get to a better place. And so that's, in very rough terms, the main difference. Yeah.
Hi. In Christianity, we have a good holy God and an angel Lucifer who was good and who rebelled and who now is Satan, and the demons and evil angels. So in these other religions, especially I'm interested in Islam and Hinduism, do they believe that there's, what is their origin for evil?
Mm-hmm. In the case of Islam, you won't be surprised to know that the origins are pretty similar. I mean, they believe in a Satan as well, and evil angels and so on. And so in that sense, they share a similar kind of etiology or origin myth. It's interesting, actually, because Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all of them are deficient, actually, in explaining the origins of evil. None of them actually say where the original evil impulse comes from. All of them agree that there's actually no such thing as evil, in the sense that there's no such, like, giant black blob coursing through the universe, Star Trek-like, you know, infecting things, turning them evil. So it's kind of a Platonic idea that you got to actually go visit evil. Go, oh, there's evil. It's pretty big, you know. Instead, evil is a kind of collective noun for evil decisions, evil people, evil consequences, and so on. And so why Lucifer or why Shaitan or Satan originally decides to go bad, nobody knows. He just does. And in fact, the Genesis record of Jews and Christians, when Adam and Eve decide to go bad, there's no explanation for why. Why didn't they just keep doing what God, who'd always been nice to them, told them to do? There's no actual explanation of it. There's an account of it happening rather than an explanation of what's going on psychologically within them. In the case of Hinduism, there's multiple explanations depending on the kind of Hinduism, up to and including the idea that the Supreme Being is himself both good and evil. And Shiva, who is one of the great Hindu gods, is often depicted as having two faces or two selves, and he is both a good and evil. And some of you remember, of course, the famous quote from the Los Alamos experiments, and Oppenheimer saying, quoting from the Bhagavad Gita, "I have become death, destroyer of worlds." This idea, I'm God. I mean, I'm both. So there's that sense in which good and evil are in the divine itself. Not unlike the intuition of the Greeks, which also saw on Olympus good and evil mixed up in that kind of celestial soap opera, you know, that was the Greek gods. But the good and evil actually are right there among the gods themselves. So different religions have different approaches to that. And as it turns out, I've written a book on the problem of evil, which deals with some of this in the opening chapters. So thanks, Mom, for mentioning that. You're way too young to be my mom. I'm sorry. That was a self-serving joke. But I did actually write a book called "Can God Be Trusted? Faith in the Challenge of Evil," based on a course I used to teach at the university on the problem of evil, and that will help you give a little bit of a sketch that way, at least. Okay, thanks.
There have been a bunch of books written lately about near-death experiences. Your opinions on those books?
Yeah, I haven't encountered a. There's near-death experiences, and then there's death experiences. Near-death experiences seem to me, if we pull those apart, near-death experiences are, I almost died and had this kind of liminal, borderline kind of experience, and then the sort of death experience, I was actually dead and I went to heaven, you know, and I have now returned with, to coin a phrase, proof of heaven. Well, probably not, actually. I mean, how many of you have read Proof of Heaven? Some of you read that just bestseller, and you might want to go online and look at the recent Esquire article that shows the kind of person that this individual actually is, despite his presentation. In my experience, everybody who has come back to report these experiences has been shown later by investigative journalists to be quite questionable. I don't know about that cute little boy who comes back from heaven. I haven't had a chance to look at that story. But all the adults that I know of are under a cloud once investigators get to probe their sense of things. And it seems to me that they don't actually tell us very much. They don't add anything to our store of religious knowledge. They just come down on the side of one or another version of that, and usually a fairly sentimental version of that. I mean, it's very Western, it's very sentimental, it's very much like a lot of us wish it were, which makes me wonder whether they actually saw it or whether they just hoped they'd see it. So I don't have expertise in that area, but I'm a little skeptical of it. A lot skeptical of it. I'm just looking for where the mic has ended up. Okay, yep. And I can pass it around here. Who's got the other one? Please.
My question has to do with the source of reliability for the different religions. Mm-hmm. If I were to have a conversation with folks about these matters, I'd want to know what their basis, what their documents, how reliable were their documents. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty convinced Christianity's documents are reliable. Are the others?
Well, this is an interesting question. Could you understand that okay? This raises an interesting question. This is the way Christians typically talk. Now, I'm acting as if I'm not a Christian. I am. But this is the way we typically talk. And that's because we're used to a certain way of approaching religion. That is to say, our religion says that certain things happened in history, particularly the career of Jesus of Nazareth, We also say that those things are reliably reported to us in our Holy Scriptures, in our Holy Book. We also say that it matters ultimately what you make of those accounts as to whether you are right with God or not, and you need to believe that those things actually happened and put your trust in Jesus as the one who is reliably reported on in Scripture as Lord and Savior. And that is that loading up on history, that this stuff really happened, that God really did these things in this individual, and therefore you can trust God with your future. You see the kind of dynamic I'm suggesting? This really happened in the past, and therefore you can trust God now and in the future. That's a very Jewish way of arguing. It starts actually with the Jews. I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of the house of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Therefore you shall have no other gods before me, and you will trust me to bring you to the promised land. That dynamic of, since this really happened, you can trust me now and in the future, starts with the Jews. It actually doesn't have precedent in any other religion. So it matters to Jews and to Christians whether the events depicted, especially the crucial events that are depicted in their Bibles, actually happened. If God really didn't rescue Israel from Egypt, if there was no Exodus, that's a real problem for biblical Jewish religion. And if God did not raise Jesus from the dead, the Christian scriptures say, then our faith is in vain. So these two religions really load up on history in a way that even Islam doesn't. Islam, instead, isn't a narrative. If you've read the Quran, you know that it's a series of actually quite disconnected stanzas or poems and so on. And what really matters there is the truth of the teaching about God as relayed through the example and the sayings of the Prophet. And it's not really quite so important what happened as that this is true teaching, which now guides God's people in the present and in the future in the worldwide expansion of God's kingdom in Islam. Even more is that true then, that history in a sense doesn't matter when we move to India and to China and Japan. And now the stories of where the Buddha comes from, or where Lao Tzu comes from, or where Kongzi comes from, or where Amaterasu comes from, don't really matter very much, because these stories are symbolizations of the abiding eternal truths of our map of the world. And so if you were to go to a fairly sophisticated or modern Indian person, or a Japanese person, or a Chinese person who was interested in their traditional religions, and say, I'm pretty sure that Krishna really didn't grow up in the village of Vrindavan, or I'm pretty sure Lao Tzu doesn't even actually exist, they wouldn't be troubled by that. Because that's not the point. The point is this picture we get from our religions a true picture of the world, and is the remedy we are prescribed by the religion the best way to live in the world? And whether there's actually a historical Lao Tzu or not, just really doesn't matter. So it's a very different understanding of authority. Each group, as I say, each religion is offering us a map on the world, and they offer grounds to believe it depending on the kind of product, so to speak, they're offering. And you can appreciate that the grounds will vary then, depending on whether you're saying this is a historical narrative which you should be a part, the Jewish and Christian understanding, as opposed to this is the timelessly true map of the world that we have encoded in our various legends and sayings and stories and poems. And it doesn't matter whether they're actually literally true, you're missing the point. The point is, these are simply truths that are depicted in this vital way. Okay? Yeah, we'll go back here and then up here. Yeah, please.
Hi. So you mentioned that one of the ways that we can process through what religion we should believe in is by asking the question based on our experience. And I think in American society and Western society, one of the religions we're most exposed to is Christianity. And so we do, as Christians, we grow up in this society and we find it to be true, and then we choose to believe it. But we don't necessarily have the exposure to many Eastern religions. And so I guess a question I have is, from your experience, what have you found as you've been learning going through these religions, what have you found to be potentially missing from these areas that, you know, Christianity has covered or addressed? You know, why are you still choosing to be Christian, I guess?
Yeah. Well, thanks. There's a couple of good things wrapped up in that. First, the fact that I was raised in Canada by Christian parents helps to explain why I'm a Christian today. It doesn't fully explain it, though, because I don't actually still agree with my parents about everything. And children are known to occasionally disagree with their parents, even about important things. So to say that it's more likely that I'm going to be a Christian, sociologically speaking, because I'm raised in Canada by Christian parents, is true. It's kind of a truism, actually. But it doesn't mean that, therefore, I have automatically opted for Christianity, and I appreciate that you're asking me the question you are, because a lot of my students would sometimes feel that, well, I think Christianity is true, but then that's what I would think, being raised in Canada by Christians. But if I were in India, being raised by Sikhs or Jains or Hindus or something, then I would think that's true. Well, that may be, but that has to do with the sociology of how we acquire religious beliefs. It has nothing to do with their truthfulness. Sure, you're probably going to believe what your parents believe unless you have terrible parents or their views can't possibly explain your life, but it doesn't have anything to do with whether they're true or not. You see what I'm saying? So it's a genetic fallacy. You don't have to worry about it. Where things come from doesn't explain their truthfulness. So as you say, I've had a chance to explore at least a little bit of some other religions as well. And in the brief time I have in a Q&A session, I'll say just two things. Number one, I found out two things. Number one, that Christians aren't right about everything. I learned that early, actually. In my own family, and then learned it at church, learned it again at Bible school, learned it again. In fact, I learn it weekly. The Christians don't know everything, and a lot of what we think we know is wrong. In fact, I'm a fairly fierce critic of Christianity and the Christian church, because I think we get a lot of things wrong, and we do a lot of things badly, and that's one of the reasons I'm glad I have tenure. It's important sometimes. Let me tell you, it's important sometimes. So the fact that I'm a Christian and my allegiance is to Jesus and I think that the Bible is the Word of God actually gives me grounds on which to critique myself and my fellow Christians, because I don't think we live up to our own ideals properly. I think we misunderstand our own book, and when we understand it, we often don't practice it. So there's that to say. I don't think Christians are better than everybody else. In fact, I have abundant evidence that in many respects we're not better than other people, person for person and so on. And then secondly, I've learned a lot from other religions. I've learned a lot of wonderful ways of putting things that are similar to or compatible with my Christian faith. I don't see that these are some kind of distraction from my Christian faith. But in the case of Taoism, for instance, I find the Taoist idea of going with the flow, of not pushing too hard, straining against the way the world is, but recognizing the way the world is. This is very good for my type A personality. The Taoism will say, if you keep straining against the world will break you. And I have tried to learn that before the world breaks me. So I've been appreciative of that. And I've been appreciative of things I've learned in other religions as well. And Christianity has a long career of borrowing from other religions and other philosophies, other ways of looking at the world, whether those be philosophical ways or scientific ways or technological ways or ritual ways or artistic ways. We're actually pretty shameless. We'll steal from everybody. That's a really great way of celebrating the midwinter season. We're going to call that a Christmas tree now, because that's so cool. And we're gonna use our own symbols to explain it. But thanks, lovers of Thor or Woden or whoever it was who gives us the Northern German Christmas tree, well, we're going to call it the Christmas tree. And thank you, Greek philosophers, for thinking the way you have about the world. We don't agree with you, but we're going to borrow your terminology. We're actually going to make a lot of hay in that in our own Christian theology. And thank you, and so on. So we're happy to do that kind of thing, because we think truth is truth wherever we find it. But to me, the center of the Christian faith is about the center. It's about Jesus Christ. It's not about practicing the Christian religion. It's about being rightly related to God through Jesus Christ. And the whole point of getting to know Jesus is to get to know God and to have everything kind of fall into place. That other religions have lots of good things to offer us. What I think Christianity offers is the main thing that Christianity offers, namely Christ. And now, I have to go back to an ancient technology. Some of you will remember, and especially some of you audiophiles still know about, something called vinyl records. Now, bear with me, kiddies, but before there was digital, there was analog, and we would have these black, thin plates of plastic, and they would have a hole drilled in the middle, and you put them on a little spindle, and then you would put a... I know it sounds like wax cylinders, you'd buy these records, as we called them, and you would play them, and they actually made music. Now, the problem was, every once in a while, you'd get one out of the jacket, and the machine hadn't punched the hole right in the middle. You remember that, old-timers? And you'd put this record on, and everything else would be perfectly fine about the record, but the hole was off-center, and and it seems to me that's what Christianity offers, is it puts the right thing in the center. It puts Jesus in the middle, and then everything else can find its proper place. And that's really the main reason why I'm still a Christian. Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
I think you've answered my question for the most part, but I was curious, maybe more in depth, about how this knowledge that you have of different religions informs the way that you approach people in these different religions. And I don't know if you're going to give us input on that or advice on that at some point in your speaking, but I'm curious personally for you what difference that's made.
Well, it's made me... I think when I encounter people of other religious backgrounds, it helps me, of course, get into the conversation with them because I have some common vocabulary with them. I have some sense of where they're coming from. And it also helps me to be on my guard because I don't think we should be sentimental about this. I mean, there is bad religion in the world. And I have been pretty neutral about my presentation tonight, but I believe there are forms of religion that are bad for people. They're bad for individuals, they're bad for other people who don't believe in those religions, they're bad for their enemies, and they stir up trouble. I also believe that most of the great traditions contain both happy, fairly benign views and versions, and others are pretty dark, militaristic, and even in some cases, esoteric forms of religion that really trade on the dark side of things. So it helps me be alert. Just because somebody comes from another religion, I am neither happy nor sad. I simply am informed, and then we can talk about whatever it is we want to talk about. But it also helps me appreciate that something we all should know, but I need to keep reminding myself of, is that people do look at the world quite differently than I do. And I mostly don't think that. Do you? I mean, I have to confess, most of the time, I think most people look at the world pretty much the way I do. But in fact, lots and lots of people look at it quite differently. What they count as a day well spent is different from me. And what they count as the right way to treat your kid is different from me. And what they count as the best place to put your charitable money is very different from me. And so learning about world religions helps me make sense of what I read in the newspaper or I get on my Google News and say, oh yeah, there it is. These are different views of the world playing themselves out for better and for worse. So there's lots of benefits to it, but those are a couple, at least, that come to mind. Okay, so she's asking me, that helps, you know, this knowledge helps me to converse with other people, but now she was asking me, how does this help me convert other people to Christ? And I'd love to answer that, but we're out of time.
Or do you feel like you're called to do that?
Oh yeah, I do. I mean, all Christians are called to participate with God in God's work of drawing people to himself through Jesus Christ. Oh yeah, I mean, I'm an old-fashioned Christian that way. I mean, it's right there in the Bible a bunch of times. So we are to cooperate with God that way. But what that means is complex. How that actually works out is sometimes complex. Sometimes it's pretty simple, but often it's complex, which is why I wrote another book called Humble Apologetics, which tries to take into account the complexities of our conversations today. So when I meet somebody else of a different outlook. They might have a different proper noun religion from me. They might be a secular humanist. In fact, a couple of card-carrying secular humanists came to hear lectures I gave downtown Vancouver a couple weeks ago. It might be somebody who's just got her own take on things. My duty to her is to love her. I'm to love my neighbor, in fact, as I love myself. And if she comes to me and says, I'm a single mom and I need a babysitter because my other child is really sick. my response is not supposed to be, well, you know, you really should get right with Jesus. That's what you really need right now. And important as your kid is, are you ready to go meet Jesus? That would be, you know, like, that's not even funny, right? That'd be obscenely off target. And so I've learned not to do that. Yeah, some teenage stories I'll tell you another time, but learn not to do that and say, yes, first things first, what you need right now is a babysitter. Go look after your other kid. And I love her according to my capacity and to her need and the occasion. And if she also wants to talk about religious matters, I'll happily talk to her about religious matters. And if she says, I'd really like you to correct my theology, I'm there. Don't get as many people asking me as you might think. But I'm ready, and I'm ready to do it as I can. And this knowledge about the way other people see things just helps me to do that a little bit better than I would otherwise. Okay? Yeah, come on up.
Well, thanks so much for all your questions, and sorry to have to shut it down, but we've reached the end of our time. And again, thanks so much for coming. Great to see so many of you here, and great to see so many new faces. So if you're visiting us, a very warm, again, warm welcome to you. Thanks for coming.